friend of ours who thinks that they can turn the Tea Party people, that they are disaffected, and they will, that we can argue them into the left, which is a big mistake.
I think there are some of them that can be persuaded, actually.
There may be some of them, but for the most part, they're just there because they can't stand that there's a not completely white male who is president of the United States. I don't care. I will say that the a large part of the Tea Party movement is very racist. At the very least, it's classist. You know.
I mean, we talk about the Tea Party. I think we have to realize that there's dozens of different groups out there that are calling themselves Tea Party. I mean, of course, the most visible one, the one that's given the most airtime to corporate media, is the one by, that's created by the Koch brothers. Bill, I remember.
And Dick Armey.
No,
I'll never have aphasia about
Here's
Dick
the thing.
Oh, Dick Armey.
Okay.
I oppose an increase of the minimum wage with every fiber of my being.
Yeah.
I remember him saying that.
Yeah, Bill, turned you off because
back
you were
a year
enough.
Or so ago when there was some protests going on and the people that were protesting were labeled as Tea Party, part of the Tea Party movement. They had people had signs, hands off my Social Security, hands off my Medicare.
I
remember we commented about that, you in particular, saying about these people are dumb. Well, you know what? Now with this Obama commission, maybe they knew something we didn't. Maybe
Hold on, Bill. Let me finish here.
Maybe they weren't Tea Party people. Maybe they were just labeled that in the corporate media.
I think they actually had the cognitive dissonance that we described. That they don't regard as Medicare and Social Security as part of the big government in some way. I don't know.
But they were talking about defending it. You know,
the famous guy with the mullet and the mustache with the sign that says something about the morons. Mm. What is it with the, why don't people like people named Moran? Actually, he was supposed to write Moron. I mean,
Well, there is Jim Moran in the house. Maybe he was referring to him, and he was from Virginia. Somebody else would get the joke.
Obvious if you see the picture. But I'm just going to say, these people, they are a media creation.
Yes, absolutely.
You can go back to the Ron Paul Tea Party thing, which never got really anywhere. But that was that guy on, CNBC?
Santarelli something like that.
Who came out and called for the Tea Party, and then all of a sudden it just popped up all over the place. I was at the original Tea Party thing here in Champaign on the 15th, and it almost erupted into violence when a friend of mine came up. There was one of these people there. They're supposed to be such upstanding conservative Christian people. This guy was calling this woman every name in the book, and I stepped in, and the guy gets in my face, and I'm not that big. This dude's 2 inches shorter than me, and I can't believe he must have been an idiot to be doing that. I'm sorry. I just cannot stand these people.
Well, I go back to
a visceral hatred of
the structural racism of the Tea Party and the economic system broader is, you know, it's bigger than the Tea Party. And this guy that you on MSNBC, who is an economic analyst on the floor of one of the trading
Board of Trade in Chicago.
And he's saying that bailing these people out who got mortgages that they shouldn't have is outrageous. And the crowd cheered him on. From the floor of
all these wealthy traders.
Yes,
indeed. And this is racist because these people were victims.
Oh, yeah.
Half of the minorities who got subprime loans could have qualified for prime loans. They were just ripped off.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got this guy here on the board of WEFT who says, well, they should have studied it better. I mean, I know what it's like to go into
a balloon loan and I didn't realize it from the State Bank of B Mint, the people I grew up with who I thought would treat me right, and they ripped me off.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, there's a lot of things connected here, and it's just indisputable that the complications of the process is amazingly, and you know, we know that because the bankers don't even know who owns the property. And there was just a ruling somewhere just in Massachusetts, I guess, that said that if you can't document your paper, you cannot evict anybody. You can't not evict somebody.
Yeah, it was done by a judge, I think, originally in Ohio, actually.
Uh-huh.
And then maybe it spread to Massachusetts. But anyway, it looks like we're going into the labor hour. Paul, we'd really welcome you to open with a theme song and continue this conversation if you want.
One more thing on this theme. I was listening to Beyond the Beltway on WLS last week.
Mm.
They had a writer that called in that they were talking about, and I can't remember the name of his book. He claims that this entire financial crisis was created by socialist democratic politicians who found that they could not do top-down socialism in the 70s, so they had been spending the last 30 years in a conspiracy with Acorn engineering this.
Oh, unreal. There's another good one circulating. It was the bankers in Geneva who actually called for more capital and less leverage. That's actually this international bank that's attacking the U.S. So there are all sorts of...
Yeah, oh, Matthew Rothschild's family, right? You know, Rothschild means red shield in German. That was the symbol of the banks. It was a. I was doing some conspiracy reading this week.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't put too much on that.
It's not German. Rothschild is not German. It doesn't mean red
shield.
Well,
it would be I can't remember.
It'd be Rote.
That's right. They recognize that. Okay. They didn't. Yeah. They.
So it's a transliteration. Anyway, enough. Enough. Here's the theme.
One. Hello, welcome to the Illinois World Labor Hour, the Saturday, January 8th edition. I'm your host, David Johnson, here with co-hosts Bill Gorell and Paul Muth from News from Neptune sitting in with us. Unfortunately, Bob Polesny and Jason Kozlowski are gone for the weekend and just got information that Tom Thomas is definitely ill with the flu and won't be able to make it today.
Oh, my gosh.
So, but anyway, the views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers, do not represent WEF's board of directors or associates. And anyway, we have some interesting stories here today, some news stories and stuff for you. And we're going to have pretty much sort of a stream of consciousness freestyle discussion on some various issues affecting working people today. And we're also going to play a fair amount of music. So anyway, we'll start today's headlines with Paul Muth, who's generously agreed to sit in with us and help us on the show.
Okay, we got a story from the auto industry. This is Honda workers in Mexico facing repression and firings. It's posted by Huberto Juarez Nunez just before Christmas, labornotes.org. For more information, we won't be getting to all of it. Honda workers at a plant in Mexico have struggled for years against a hostile company, corrupt union, and subservient government. This month, they took their battle public, making violations of their rights visible and gaining allies at home and abroad. In reprisal today, management fired a leader of the new union. You can there's a call for action at the bottom of this page. You can find it at Labor Notes. Maybe we'll get to that. The workers are from the plant in El Salto, Jalisco, that makes the CRV truck. 2,100 workers on two shifts assemble 5,000 trucks a month, most of them exported to the U.S. This production in Mexico has given Honda a more stable position in relation to other auto companies, which have experienced a profound crisis in the North American market. I drive a VW made in Mexico, not in the same state of Jalisco, but anyway, back to the text. But behind the quality of this product hide retrograde labor relations. Honda management has systematically ignored the rights of the workers with the support of the federal and local labor authorities. They've denied the workers the exercise of the right of free association and maintain against their will a protection union. This is a company union, official union in the country, a government union, I guess, a CTM, the Central de Trabajadores de Mexico. This Charo union, and that's an expression I'm not entirely able to explain to you. Maybe one of my colleagues here does.
As a company union.
A Mexican call unions that serve the employers. Mm-hmm. And plays the official role of formally complying with Mexican law, but in reality it is an instrument that management uses to keep salaries the lowest of all the assembly plants in the country. The daily wage is $10 to $12.30 per day. In contrast, the Volkswagen plant in Puebla, which has an independent union, pays $29 per day. Given the absence of the real union, the government overloads the jobs with the company overloads the jobs. I'm sorry, I don't know how I did that. With the consequent jump in accidents, the atmosphere at Honda is one of constant hostility and contempt for the dignity of the workers on the part of the foreman. Honda's logo reads, "The Power of Dreams." A nightmare for these guys, apparently. Since 2009, workers have been resisting and have held several work stoppages to demand that management modify its demands and its attitude. In every case, management has responded with repression and firings of the workers it saw as leaders. This year, workers began building a real union as one way to defend their rights. They elected an executive committee for their United Workers Union of Honda Mexico. But local and federal authorities, under pressure from Honda, have systematically denied, under whatever pretext, the recognition of the Democratic Union. The workers decided to up the ante. They held a press conference December 9th in Mexico City and another December 13th in Guadalajara, the state capital of Jalisco. At both events, Mexican unions expressed their solidarity, in particular the Independent Union of Volkswagen Workers in Puebla. Workers wore paper bags over their faces to ward off reprisals from Honda. But on December 20th, management fired the union's secretary general, Jose Luis Solorio. President Bob King of the United Auto Workers has sent a letter of solidarity, making a change in the international policies of the UAW. King wrote, quoting, "We understand that for far too long the employers of the automobile industry have been able to divide us by race, border, language, and political orientation while increasing their profits as our wages, benefits, and working conditions stagnate and get worse. It is continuing on with his statement. It is time to say enough to the politics of division that make us weaker. That's Bob King of UAW. For independent Mexican unions, this creates an opportunity to develop ties of unity in a time when the companies are aggressively exploiting union fragmentation and the salary difference between Mexican and U.S. workers to increase their profits. They're calling for people to write to Honda in Mexico. I guess you can Google that and find it out.
Okay, what I'm going to do here, folks, is turn you to a article or editorial in The Nation magazine. Actually, The Nation, I often do not agree with its conclusions as it is liberal left, but quite often their reporting is fairly good. And this is by Eric Alterman. And he starts out, according to Newsweek's Jonathan Alter, the president recently told friends, quote, "All I want for Christmas is an opposition I can negotiate with." Well, he had one briefly, for so long as he was willing to cave in to its demands to bust the budget with a massive gift of more than $130 billion in tax cuts to the wealthiest 2% of the country and the gutting of the estate tax. That cleared the decks for other victories and compromises that led to the widespread insider approval of Obama's ability to, quote, make the system work. And like 13-year-olds at the movies, pundits love action, period, never minding its consequences. This is me and my voice saying, you might remember that John Boehner said before the election that if it came down to voting only to retain the middle-class tax cut and to give up the upper-class tax cut, he would, of course, vote for that.
Vote for the upper tax cut.
No, vote to go ahead and give up the upper-class tax cut to retain the middle class.
He was really reined in rather quickly.
Yeah, he said that before the election. And, and of course, Obama does not start bargaining. He starts bargaining where he wants to be. You know, he doesn't know anything about negotiating. But anyway.
He does. But it's the point is yeah. that it's a front. Never mind.
Yeah. But anyway, moving on down through the article, he discusses about how Republicans are always talking about fiscal responsibility as they axe the taxes that pay for things. Oh, by the way, this is Eric Alterman. I'm sorry if I mispronounce that. And this paragraph goes, think about it. Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush talked incessantly about fiscal responsibility and lost no opportunity to denounce deficit spending. But these principles flew out of the window when it came time to cut taxes on the rich. The new bunch are even worse. Incoming House Ways and Means Committee Chair Dave Camp recently told George Will, remember George Will of
Town
Urbana,
boy.
Illinois, originally, that one of the biggest problems with our tax system is that too few poor people pay income tax. Oh, no, they do. I think they make up for it with regressive sales taxes and also higher rents due to property taxes, in my opinion. Well, anyway, they come down and they discuss about how they don't want to fund the Build America Bonds program, which me, being a construction worker, largely dependent on government spending, is really bad. It says these bonds, which make up roughly 20% of all new debt sold by states and local governments because of a federal subsidy of some 35% of interest costs, it ended on New Year's Eve. And they don't want to do that. They don't want to bring it back, even though the states face altogether $140 billion budget shortfall next year, according to the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. And some people predict that the figure could rise to as much as $3 trillion over time, when one includes unfunded liabilities to pay for retiree benefits. Well, I remember wasn't that many years ago when you didn't hear the word trillion that much.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and they say it serves the purpose of the Republican class war in two respects. It forces localities to slash their budgets for services like snow removal and public schooling. And it may cause them to default on their pension obligations to their, as I'm going to say right now, sarcastically, coddled public employees. And you might have noticed lately, folks, there's been a lot of speaking against
public
employees trying to get you to envy them when actually instead of envying public employees, we should all be banding together to make our jobs at least as good. And, by the way, quite often, they don't have as good a deal as equivalent employees in the private sector.
In some ways.
Amy Goodman this week on Wednesday, I think it was, had an interview Juan Gonzalez helped out with about this situation of the attack on the public employees union, and was pointing out the AFL-CIO actually had an emergency meeting where they were trying to get the private sector unions to stop attacking public sector workers.
Yeah, and unfortunately, yes. It's mainly the building trades that the capitalist class has been able to con again into pursuing the capitalist agenda.
Yes. I've seen some quotes from some building trades union officials in various states. Well, and so later on down here in the in the article, they cite some examples of the defunding of localities. Hamtramck, Michigan, recently profiled in the New York Times as a future to which these Republicans look forward. The town already ceased taking care of the trees and the grass on public property. Usually it's against the law for private citizens not to mow their grass. And ran out of money for street plowing just before the recent blizzard. Localities like Hamtramck are getting little help from the state legislature, however. Quote, all our communities have done is cut, 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 said Sumner Hallwood Minnick, director of state affairs for the Michigan Municipal League. They're down to four-day work weeks and the elimination of parks and senior centers, all of that. So if there's anything else that happens, they will be over the edge. Oh, man, I'm going to miss the libraries when they go. Okay, ditto Pritchard, Alabama, which recently ceased mailing monthly pension checks in violation of state law. A retired fire marshal, died in June and was found without running water or electricity in his house. These are extreme cases, but the danger is widespread. Rare is a locality whose pension obligations are fully funded, and none are dealing with it terribly responsibly. New Jersey, for instance, under Republican hero, I'm sick of hearing about this guy, Governor Chris Christie, simply refused to fork over the $3.1 billion due its pension plan this year. He'll just worry about that tomorrow. Well, that sounds familiar to people who live in Illinois. The Democrats run everything in Illinois, don't they?
Again, it's the influence of corporate money. It has nothing or very little to do with whether it's the Republicans or the Democrats. They're both bought and paid for.
By the way, as an aside, gee, thanks, Democrats, for not passing the medical marijuana law. The law that they were promoting was extremely restrictive to nothing like California's at all, and they wouldn't pass that.
Because the farmers,
Democrats, and the Illinois,
Well, what's ironic, in the last year of ex-Governor Ryan's term, he was more progressive than Quinn or even Blagojevich in a lot of his pronouncements as far as wanting to normalize relations with Cuba, putting a moratorium on the death penalty.
Well, I'm kind of thinking he might have been worried about that prison sentence he saw come. No. I'm being cynical there. Yeah.
Still.
Well, and there were a lot of other issues he wasn't as progressive.
I understand.
Quinn is, even
I understand.
It's kind of lame to talk about
But even the Democrats, yelled heresy when he talked about ending the embargo on Cuba, and even many of them did the same when he talked about a moratorium on the death penalty.
Yeah, not only would ending the embargo on Cuba help Illinois farmers, which I think is not the major reason to do it, it would just really help the Cuban people.
Well, yeah.
Oh, but we can't do that. We can't have the example of socialism on our shore.
Well, they say we got to do it because they're communists. Well, what about China?
Think
about
it. Right.
China. Why is China good, Cuba bad?
Because
the corporations in this country cut a deal with the dictatorial communist government in China to move their facilities there, use their cheap and slave labor to build these products and to ship back after all these American jobs are lost and, everything we buy now almost is from China.
Dave, me being aged, and I think that Paul's older than we are too, so he can probably remember this pretty well. I remember when Richard Nixon went to China. Only Richard Nixon could go to China.
Yeah.
because everybody else would be soft on communism.
Yeah, only Republican could open relations with China, and only a Democrat could break Social Security.
That's right. Well, anyway, they kept talking about this huge market that was going to open up. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking to myself, even as a teenager, I kept thinking, what market? They don't have any money. What are they talking about? Such a big market. We aren't going to sell them anything. I wasn't thinking labor market.
High repression, low wage labor.
Yep. But it took 20, how many, almost, yeah, it took over 20 years to finally break that open. And thank you, Bill Clinton, for the WTO deal with China, too.
And the China Preference Treaty.
Okay. A sixth of the carbon dioxide emitted by China is used to manufacture goods that come to the U.S. That gives you an indication of how much of their economy is related to export. And one wonder what percentage of that is actually multinationally produced material. So, you know, it isn't just China that's making the money by exporting to us. It's these large corporations that are,
of course,
getting it hand over fist, and they're also not paying workers here.
Yes, and I have solidarity with Chinese workers. Let me make that clear.
And
we're depending on them to rise up, actually, mm-hmm. to a large extent.
Well, yeah, well, Dave, my whole thing about foreign workers is I want to see them. We know how to do this. We did this in the United States and Europe 100 years ago. We know how this works. I want to see, I'm not going to say a middle class. I want to see the middle income. Mm-hmm. Forget middle class. Middle class is the petite bourgeoisie.
Yes. Yes.
I don't want to be middle class. I'm not middle class.
We're working class. Yes.
I want to be middle income working class. Mm-hmm. I want the Chinese workers to be middle income working class. I want the Mexican workers. I want the North Korean guitar. I'm not North Korean, but the South Korean guitar builders that send a lot of guitars, great guitars. Ibanez is a fantastic. I mean, Tom Morello is seeking an endorsement with Ibanez, even Tom Morello. But anyway, I want them to have their own middle income so they can develop their internal markets and do like what Henry Ford said, the Marxist capitalist anti-Semite Henry Ford. I want them to be able to buy their own products.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
I want them to buy stuff from us, too. And I want to buy a few things from them.
But that's totally opposite of what the corporate free trade agenda is all about. They don't want that. They want people pushed down to subservience to where they can pay them just enough to survive. And they want that. Now they're turning their focus and doing the policies here in the United States. They're pushing us down to a third world country status. The Chilean economist Neff, I think his last name is, has a whole new term for it, de-developing country. That's right. What the United States is, a de-developing country. It's not an act of God. This is intentional policy decided in corporate boardrooms and the bought and paid for politicians that the corporations buy.
Yes, and also, and other people, this is neo-feudalism.
Yes, indeed. That's exactly what the system they want to institute is, going back to feudalism, to where the wealthy and the corporate CEOs are the new aristocracy, and all the rest of us are serfs with basically just enough money to survive and no rights whatsoever.
Another insidious part of it is that what's going to save us, supposedly, according to the movers and shakers in Washington, we need to export more. That means that people here, they're acknowledging that people here don't have the money to buy the things that are being made wherever they're being made, and they're going to export more to other countries.
Right, Paul.
The comprador, the rich elites in the other countries are now seen as the market.
You're absolutely right, Bill. That's the economic model we should be pursuing, is to where every worker in every country has a comfortable living wage, to where it's middle, like you said, middle income, to where they have their own internal market to produce all enough goods to keep them self-sufficient, and that yet the goods that can't be produced in like one area of the world where it can be in the other, then that would be the basis that would form then what international trade happens.
Gee, wasn't that the original idea of Adam Smith and others of his ilk? And also, too, going back, Paul mentioned about purchasing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was a story, I believe it was last week, where last year American corporations created 2.4 million jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but only 1 million of them was in the United States.
Yep.
And it was mainly they created more jobs overseas, not so much to bring stuff to the United States, but because they now are having more markets overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means, the only thing that has saved the American consumer, the American worker, over the last, I would say, 20 to 30 years, is that we are the buyers, the consumers of last resort for the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now that we have lost that status, they don't need us anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And when they cook the world with the global warming, they're going to be the ones in the domed estates circling the Arctic. And we're going to be out cooking and being bitten by malaria-ridden mosquitoes with no medicine. It'll be just like the movie Zardoz.
Good movie, by the way.
Yeah, and but the biggest problem, and Paul had Dean Baker on his show earlier, News mm-hmm. from Neptune, discussing finance capital, and I was just reading an interesting article by Michael Hudson, who, by the way, wrote
it. Good economist, yes.
Yeah, wrote it for a class in Marxism in China, where about Marx's ideas on finance capital, and he said that Marx did not think that there would ever become such a supremacy of finance capital, even though he did realize the danger if that would happen. And basically, what we're coming down with, I mentioned the new feudalism. Instead of a landed aristocracy of worthless rentier jerks
mm-hmm.
that were hated by the industrialists 150 years ago, now we have the financial aristocracy of worthless leeches, parasite jerks
mm-hmm.
that are apparently not hated by anybody. I don't know, but they have choked industry in this country, and they will do it on a worldwide level, and they will bring all people on this planet, except maybe Germany, I don't know, down to subsistence. Can you believe it? Everybody in the United
States. Why Germany?
Well, Germany, I don't know, but Germany right now, you know, everybody's like, oh, well, we can't compete because our people make too much money, and we have unions and blah, blah, blah. Well, Germany swaps off with China on being the lead exporter of the world with their, quote, coddled workers in Germany, who actually even get seats on the board of directors and 5 weeks vacation guaranteed by law.
Six weeks. Yeah.
But German workers actually haven't gotten any increases in wages over the last two or three years.
That's true. That's true. And that's, I'll tell you what, we've allowed to happen.
Sharing of work that's going on to some extent.
They had a 37-hour work week, too, that was a national strike in the 80s, early 80s, that won in the 37-hour work week, which has been taken back by the capitalists.
Well, there was criticism. I did read criticism of that in an old issue of Anarchy, a Journal of Desire Armed, where one of the ways that they got that shorter work week was by giving up their breaks. And the criticism was that the break time was a time when workers could get together and talk about their
That's an interesting point, Bill.
Problems.
One more story here, and then we're going to go to little Jim Hightower. This is kind of continuing on a story, an excellent Black Agenda Report audio that Paul Muth played in the previous News from Neptune about the Georgia prisoners' strike. On Monday morning, this is from the industrial worker from the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW. On Monday morning, when the doors open, close them. Do not go to work. They cannot do anything to us that they haven't already done at one time or another. Brothers, don't give up now. Make them come to the table. Be strong. Do not make money for the state, and they in turn use to keep us as slaves. This was a message sent out by one of the strike leaders on the fifth day of the largest prison strike in U.S. history. What started out on December 9th as a coordinated strike in at least five of Georgia's state prisons was originally intended to last only a day. But quickly, it's evolved into a larger, longer struggle when prison officials locked down a number of the prisons. The strike was coordinated by a network of prisoners using cell phones that were smuggled into the prisons. If caught with a phone, a prisoner could face five more years in prison.
Incredible.
The strike is noted for the unity and solidarity among striking prisoners of different backgrounds in a system where if there is little or no cultural, religious, or racial antagonism to begin with, the prison guards will pit groups against each other, blacks against whites and Latinos, Christians against Muslims, Rastafarians, and numerous rival gangs are all now working as one cohesive unit, as one class in this struggle against those who incarcerate and enslave them. The prisoners sent out a list of demands at the beginning of the strike, among them a living wage for work, educational opportunities, decent health care, and an end to the cruel and unusual punishments, decent living conditions, nutritional meals, vocational and self-improvement opportunities, access to families, and fair parole decisions. An underlying demand of the thousands of prisoners on strike is an end to slave labor. Georgia's prisons are infamous. Georgia's prisoners are forced to work in the prison system without being paid, some for companies contracted through the prison system. But most prisoners are forced to do the work necessary to maintain the functioning of the prison. This forced labor the strikes maintain is in clear violation of the 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which abolished slavery. One of the calls put out by strike leaders was, "No more slavery. Injustice in one place is injustice to all. Inform your family to support our cause. Lockdown for liberty." I tell you, this is quite an inspirational
story.
Right.
There's a lot of skeptics out there that I say these guys are criminals and
they don't deserve anything.
Right? Which is so retrograde. And the further coverage of Black Agenda reports on this story is amazing. Some of the people that they, just like the Honda workers in Mexico get fired, some of these guys got beat up.
Yes, the leaders.
They got kept away from any press.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, the hammer came down on them for having the temerity to ask for health care. And much less some money. Prison wages are not good. There's precedents are set, and they're supposed to be rehabilitated into society, right? So
well,
making them slaves is going
to
help
wage
them
too.
Yeah, and the thing is, for every job a prisoner does, it takes away a job out there.
I do like that Jim Baker only got $11. The preacher Jim Baker only got 11 cents an hour for cleaning toilets. But anyway, one thing real quick, Dave. This is another place where the left has been very remiss, that along with anti-drug war movements, is that they have let the prisoners go. Nobody will speak for prisoners because it's so unpopular. And I want to salute a friend of ours, Sandra Otten, for being instrumental in getting the Books to Prisoners program started several years ago. And I would urge people to go to their sales. You can get great books when they have their sales, and it raises funds.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Thank you, Sandra, and thank you, Bill, for bringing it up. That's very important. Okay, we are going now to some Jim Hightower, and we'll be right back.
Last year, Democrats claimed that the new financial reform law they passed had finally shut down the Wall Street casinos, those flim-flam houses of high finance that had wrecked our economy in 2007. But the new Republican majority in the House say that they intend to undo the reforms this year. Why? Because, sobbed the GOP leaders, the law passed by those Democratic meanies was too harsh on the millionaires who run Wall Street. So they plan to loosen the restraints on them. But wait, what's that sound? Why, it's the clickety-click-click of Wall Street's roulette wheel, still spinning round and round. Despite the Democrats' reform, and even before the Republicans rushed to give aid and comfort to the poor bankers, the games never really stopped. Check out PIMCO, for example, a huge Wall Street player that's been trying to lure hotshot investors into a new gambling scheme. It promises to buy bad mortgages from troubled banks and, hocus pocus, turn them into a profitable windfall for PIMCO and the elite gamblers who are putting up at least $500,000 each. The fund, with a peppy name of Bravo, looks like the same kind of razzle-dazzle that wrecked us 3 years ago. But not to worry, for PIMCO has enlisted an all-star lineup of officials from the old Bush regime to endorse the hustle, apparently thinking that they give it some respectability. There's Josh Bolton, for example, a former Goldman Sachs honcho who was George W.'s chief of staff. While in the White House, he helped loosen Wall Street regulations to allow banks to become casinos. After they imploded, he dutifully helped orchestrate a taxpayer bailout for them. This is Jim Hightower saying, now Josh is on board with PIMCO to keep the roulette wheel spinning, and no doubt he'll get behind the GOP's effort to reopen the whole Wall Street casino. Not to mention the next bailout that they'll want.
The workers on the SP line strike sent out to call, but Casey Jones, the engineer, he wouldn't strike at all. His boiler, it was leaking, and his drivers on the bus, and his engine and its bearings, they were all out of plumb.
Casey Jones
kept his junk pile running.
Casey Jones
wonderful time.
Davy Jones
got a wooden medal for being good and faithful on the SP line.
Davy Jones, happy jump by money. Davy Jones was working all the time. Davy Jones got a wooden medal for being good and faithful on the SP line.
A worker said to Casey, won't you help us win this strike? But Casey said, let me alone, you'd better take a hike. Then someone put a bunch of railroad ties across the track, and Casey hit the river with an awful smack.
Casey Jones
hit the river bottom.
Casey Jones
broke his bloomin' spine.
Casey Jones
was an Angelino. He took a trip to heaven on the SP line.
Casey Jones hit the river bottom. Casey Jones broke his bloomin' spine. Casey Jones was an Angelino. He took the trip to heaven on the SP line.
When Casey Jones got up to heaven to the pearly gate, he said, I'm Casey Jones, the guy that pulled the SP freight. You're just the man, said Peter, our musicians went on strike. You can get a job of scabbing anytime you like.
Casey Jones
got a job in heaven.
Casey Jones
was doing mighty fine.
Casey Jones
was scabbing on the Angels just like he did to workers on the SP line.
Casey Jones got a job in heaven. Casey Jones was doing mighty fine. Casey Jones was scabbing on the Angels just like he did to workers on the SP line.
The Angels got together and they said it wasn't fair for Casey Jones to go around and scabbing everywhere. The Angels Union number 23, they sure were there, and they promptly fired Casey down the golden stair.
Casey Jones
went to hell of flying.
Casey Jones,
the devil said, oh fine.
Casey Jones,
get busy shoveling lumber. That's what you get for scabbing on the SP line.
Casey Jones went to hell a-flying. Casey Jones, the devil's hell a-flying. Casey Jones, get busy shopping for the bad. Don't you get to scabbing on the SP line.
Okay, we're back. Illinois World Labor Hour back here. That was Casey Jones from, that's a great compilation of the leftist roots of the folk revival of the 1930s. I want to thank Paul Muth and Jim Iman for this collection of songs we have from that era. And anyway, I have some quick public service announcements here. On Sunday, 5 p.m., the AWARE Anti-War and Racism Efforts weekly meetings are back at McKinley Foundation. The next one will be this Sunday, January 9th. And McKinley Foundation is at the corner of 5th and Daniel Street, 809 South 5th on the U of I campus. Please join us in the Dean Clark Room, main floor, near the game room. Bring news of the week. Bring upcoming events. Bring new ideas. 2011 has begun. See you at 5 p.m. And another public service announcement, more of a national public service announcement. I want to thank Bill Gorell for this. It's a campaign to create a national jobs program, and it's basically a vigil for jobs. And this one's going to happen, actually happened yesterday, Friday, January 7th, from 12:30 to 1:30 in front of New York Senator Schumer's Manhattan office at 757 3rd Avenue. Anyway, it said, join the vigil on the first Friday of every month, because in November 2010, 1.5 million persons were officially unemployed, and another 50 million persons wanted full-time work but were forced to work part-time or had to give up looking for work. This past year, one of every four families in America had been affected by unemployment. This must not become the new normal. The best way to solve this crisis is for the federal government to create a new national jobs program similar to the innovative work programs created by President Franklin Roosevelt during the 1930s Great Depression. Congress must also act immediately to, one, extend benefits for the long-term unemployed who have been jobless for longer than 93 to 99 weeks, and two, continue financial assistance to state and local governments to avoid massive layoffs in healthcare, education, and other essential services. Some of the speakers at the vigil were Hazel Dukes of the NAACP New York, and Bill Henning from the Communication Workers of America, Local 1180, and some of the organizations that sponsor this, the Communication Workers of America, Local 1180, Greater New York
Labor Religion Coalition, National Jobs for All Coalition, National Organization for Women, New York City Chapter of U.S. Labor Against the War, and New York City Democratic Socialists of America. So thank you, Bill, for sending in. I think that's a great idea. We need to start doing this nationwide.
That's right. I mean, you know, we need to start doing it here, as Steve Rule says. We need to do these. The revolution starts now in your own backyard, in your own hometown. And I really think that we need to start doing that. And I think we need to do it more than once a month. We need to do it as often as we can. And we need to wake people up. We need to write good leaflets and make good signs and avoid all the teabagger misspellings like Moran for Moron and so on and so forth to bring that back up. And I would like to read an announcement for you. This hour of programming is brought to you by listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of Maintenance of the Maintenance of the Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way employees are proud to continue their support for Illinois Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice of labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay. Other people call that per diem. And early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work.
Yes, Paul.
I just wanted to mention that the AWARE group, which meets at 5, is the same time I'm on the radio. I'll be back tomorrow at 5 with Window on the World. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that I think the stalwarts of the group are going to be out today in lieu of demonstration last January. I guess they didn't want to get all the problems with hungover people or something. Anyway, the monthly first Saturday of the month, I think, is between 2 and 4 today.
Okay.
At the same old place, the One Main location.
Corner of Main and Neal Street.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So I absent myself also. I'm a fair weather friend because the cold weather makes my ankle ache.
Well, I have to.
Cheers.
I have to really commend AWARE. I mean, going back to right after the invasion of Iraq, the vigils up on North Prospect, which often turned a little violent when the right wing elements came out from all over the state to intimidate and attack.
And they're probably going to teabagger rallies.
AWARE actually started at the time of the invasion of Afghanistan.
That's right, Dave.
I'm sorry, Afghanistan. Excuse me.
I remember it being extremely cold one day, and me and Susan Parenti about three other people were standing there at the exit ramp there off of Route 74 and North Prospect before the Afghanistan invasion.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, Maria Silva was there and mm-hmm. a couple other people, too.
Yes.
Of course, I just remember the attractive women that were there.
But, I mean, they turned out over hundreds of people for that. I mean, and, of course, the right-wingers turned out their people. I mean, who knows what they said to get these people there. But what was so interesting was when, after the invasion of Iraq, several weeks or even in several months, they found no weapons of mass destruction. It was amazing how quickly that right-wing element evaporated, and they quit coming to these counter-demonstrations against AWARE. But I just wanted to put that in there. They were out there in all sorts of weather every first Saturday of the month, and it was quite dramatic at times. I mean, going out there and attending several of them.
Well, and I want to tell you, too, it's just what happened there just shows you the way things are on a larger scale. The anti-war people been out there for months, years,
yes.
literally years
yes.
by
yes.
then, and no support from any businesses or anything.
Oh no, on the contrary.
And that hobby place.
Yes.
I don't care if I have to go to China to buy glue or something. I will never go to that hobby place. That guy there, I got in a big argument with him
mm-hmm.
on that.
He's
stuff.
An idiot.
He supported that. Then I don't know who the hell I can't remember who the crane people were. These were building trades people owned these cranes and had them sitting out there with the flags hanging off of them. And then good vibes. What used to be thought of as the really hip thing.
Yeah,
in
it used
the
to be
70s.
A collective. It used to be a collective.
Yeah. Now, good vibes gave them a PA system. Nobody gave us anything. That just shows you, man, on the larger scale, you have the Koch brothers with the teabaggers,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Oh, it's the business interests, of course. And, you know, Mike Griffin always pointed out when he couldn't believe when he went to Europe to get solidarity support for the locked-out Staley workers of how small business people in France identified with working people.
Right.
Their enemies were the capitalist class. They realized that it was working people's good incomes that provided them business that to sell their stuff, and also that they were in basically the same income bracket, more or less, and their common enemy was the corporate capitalist class. Now, here, on the other hand, it's totally the opposite.
Oh, yes. There were some small business people. But number one of the sad things is they get so squeezed by their corporate suppliers that they have a really difficult time paying any decent wages, I mean, at all. And another thing, too, a lot of the construction contractors around here that are union contractors are really pretty small businesses most of the time. There are many times when I'm out working on a job right with the owner of that job, of that company, and usually they're members of our unions, and they've usually come up through the ranks of the unions. For example, a great guy, and I want to say happy birthday to John Coleman. Mm-hmm. Today's his birthday.
Oh, okay. Happy birthday, John.
I believe he's 83 years old today, 83 years young. Mm-hmm. John Coleman. He's great guy, love the man, known him for many years here at WEFT, but a great asset for this radio station, being a retired electrician. John Coleman started out in the trades, has developed his own business. Mm-hmm. His sons, if I have a problem, I've called them up before and they've come out and helped me. And that's just the way it is. I mean, we're not all completely enemies of everybody. As a matter of fact, right now, just because of the way things have turned out in the construction industry, I think I'm going to try really hard to actually start my own business.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing is, Bill, a lot of people include.
But you know why? What I'm going to do is try and do really high-end stuff so I can gouge rich people. I just want to do that. So I want to come in and do their decorative concrete and charge them $200 a square foot.
Well, more like to you. That's the thing, Bill. A lot of people that are self-employed now are not by choice. It's because they had no other choice but become self-employed because they could not there were no job opportunities for them.
Well, Dave, I don't know if you've noticed this, but I've just noticed over the last 2 to 3 years – just an immense number of new vans, not new necessarily, but, I mean, ones I hadn't seen before, vans, pickup trucks, and so on and so forth, of all these new little whatever company contractors that they're just popping up all over the place, and I'm thinking it's probably because they can't find work anymore. I'm hearing about more and more carpenters having to drop out of Local 44
because there's no work. Lots of them. I mean, take early retirement or drop out. Here's an interesting thing we got from a mutual acquaintance of ours, Bill, Bob Naiman. He says, if we had a pledge of resistance to defend Social Security, like the pledge of resistance that pledged to resist a U.S. invasion of Nicaragua back in the 1980s, much of the support for cutting Social Security benefits would likely evaporate. Such a pledge could force a national debate in which proposed cuts to domestic spending and proposed military spending are examined on the same chalkboard. Obama's Deficit Commission co-chair's proposal to cut Social Security by lowering the cost of living adjustment would save $70 billion by 2020. But by comparison, drawing down U.S. troops in Afghanistan to where they were when Obama took office would save $150 billion by 2014. And to up this even better, our old friend Harry Kelber in Brooklyn, New York, has a really interesting article here where he says, to solve the budget crisis, a 10% pay cut for Obama, Congress, other officials in government, and as well as the banks and all corporate CEOs getting a 10%, an additional 10% tax increase. That's where the real savings would come from, as opposed to this effort now by the capitalist class trying to pit public sector workers against private sector workers, or actually the other way around, to get private sector workers to envy, vilify, and for the general public at large to say, to think that the public sector workers are the problems for the crisis in the state's budget, which is just BS. It's the reason the crisis is there. There's plenty of money out there. It's an intended policy to starve the states and to try to destroy public sector in general.
Yeah, Dave, I think for elected officials, I would like to give them massive raises.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways I would. However, I don't know if it would do any good because they're so incredibly greedy, because I'm thinking, well, you know, Congress is pretty much a millionaire's club.
Oh, of course.
And they weren't, most of these people weren't millionaires before they got there. So I'm thinking, hell, why don't we just pay them $1 million apiece and then maybe they won't be so corrupt.
Oh, but greed
has no
bounds.
They're going
to
be really greedy.
Of course, of course.
And of course, they want to keep getting reelected. And here's another one. I'd actually like to get rid of the current campaign finance laws. You know why?
Why?
Because it would raise the cost of buying these Congress critters, mm-hmm, as mm-hmm. Jim Hightower calls them. Mm-hmm. Right now, you can go in and give somebody, you know, just bundle your $3,000 with a whole bunch of other executives in your company and go in and give $100,000 to somebody in that bundle and get $1 billion worth of tax breaks or $1 billion worth of contracts. Mm-hmm. I mean, all these campaign finance laws did was just make it really cheap for corporations to buy.
What they need to do is to outlaw any political contributions to any candidate for public office. Outright illegal. That would stop this. I mean, because otherwise what happens is a vicious cycle where these candidates, that maybe some of them start out halfway decent, become quickly corrupted, because in order to buy radio time, that's the other thing. The other thing that has to go in conjunction with completely banning any political contribution to any candidate for public office is to require all television and radio corporate outlets to give a certain number of airtime, an equal amount, to every candidate running every race as a condition of their FCC license. Because remember, folks, we, the public, own the airwaves, not the corporations. However, in effect, they own the corporations because they control it and because our elected officials have allowed them to do this for too long.
Yeah, and also, too, you have people like Christine O'Donnell, who is a professional candidate who never wins.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, she just lives off, and they're investigating her right now, but she blames Joe Biden for that somehow. That was ridiculous. Right? She comes out, oh, so Joe Biden's making, you know, perhaps he is. I don't know. But if she's, it's just bizarre. Boy, she was a strange person. Her and that Sharon Angle from Nevada. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's what I love. That is one thing. The teabaggers are helping destroy the Republican Party.
Well, you know, that's the thing is, and the corporate Democrats are destroying the Democratic Party. I mean, it's going to be real interesting to see what happens when Obama comes up for election in 2012. I mean, because frankly, I mean, there's so many people that have seen through him. So many people went out and campaigned for him because they believed his promise of hope and change.
Yeah.
You know, I almost believed him. I mean, if I hadn't have been tuned into Black Agenda Report, I would have swallowed him hook, line, and sinker, just like millions of other Americans out there. But I knew where he came from, what he'd done in the past, and who was behind him before the election. But, you know, I still was joyed when he got elected instead of John McCain. But now I'm thinking, I don't think it would have mattered.
Well, I mean, we
have the same policies as George Bush that's been happening since he's been elected. The same policies.
Well, that was the same way with Bill Clinton, Dave. In fact, I thought quite often that I would have preferred that George Bush Sr. would have won that election, because he might have really cleaned up the laborers' union.
Oh.
You know, Bill Clinton got all buddy-buddy with Arthur Koya. They were out golfing buddies and exchanging golf, whatever. And anyway, Koya got out. Yeah, he got his cushy little president emeritus where he keeps his multi-hundred-thousand-dollar salary instead of having to retire or anything.
Yeah.
And then the guy that takes his place,
Terrence O'Sullivan, yeah.
Yeah, and it'd be the same thing in the Carpenters, Dave. You know that if anybody was in a position on the executive board of the laborers union, in a position to take that over, to get that appointment, you know that they're not, and I don't want to get into a libel suit here, but, you know, they're just, in order for them to make it, I don't think that they've got it, you know, that they're doing things in the best interest of their membership.
Okay, we got a call here. I want to see who it is. We don't normally do this, but, yes, go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I just wondered if, I mean, I don't really have an opinion one way or the other whether political donation bar freedom of speech, but I think they are protected as such by the courts, aren't they?
Well, yes, but the thing is, this is, you think about this. Why should a court?